Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Last night, Northampton's City Council voted to form a commission to study reparations. Now they join Boston, Amherst, and other communities that are grappling with whether and how to atone for the impacts of slavery and systemic racism. Now, in the reparations conversation, slavery often takes center stage. But what about here in the North? For example, we ended the practice of slavery in Massachusetts in 1783. But in her new book, No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era, author and host Jacqueline Jones points out, while the city didn't practice slavery then, it didn't practice equality or equity for its black labor force either. Jackie is here in Studio 2 with us. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, A, did I sum that up just about right?
Yes, it seems like an odd situation. Slavery was abolished in Massachusetts, as you pointed out, in 1783, and yet Boston was really a post-emancipation society with all the paradoxes and ironies that accompanied that. Many enslaved people who had been skilled workers lost their jobs as skilled workers, and they didn't own tools, they didn't have white customers, and we see actually the social division of labor in Boston staying pretty much the same throughout the 19th century, relegating many black men and women to menial labor. They were doing the same things in 1900 they were doing in 1840.
Yeah, so, and right, that's the nut here, right? In reading the book, a couple of things stood out, right? The first is that regardless of we're limited to the 1800s, roughly, right? In that 100-year time frame, the world of labor that was available to you, the world to be a self-sustaining laborer, the nature of the labor, and the ability to move through the labor force were increasingly, frankly, shrunk for black workers, regardless of whether they had been, to use terms of the time, born free or escaped from slavery in the South, or were set free by former enslavers. It felt like it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yes, look at the 19th century. Look at the dramatic events of the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution here in New England, the Civil War that claimed 750,000 lives, the rise of the retail and commercial sectors after the Civil War. All these were dramatic events that affected the labor force. And yet, again, we find many black workers still relegated to the same kinds of work. Women were servants and laundresses. The men were what they called tenders, which were kind of janitors. They were gardeners. They were doing menial labor for the most part. I do point out in the book, though, those exceptional workers, those who managed to succeed, to prosper, they tended to have white clients or white patrons. The attorney, Robert Morris, for instance, had white clients.
Joseph Clash, who was kind of, I see him as kind of the, with maybe less evil, I don't know, sort of an Al Capone of his time, right? The front businesses like the barbershop that had the clean money, and then the back businesses like what was happening in the dance halls.
Well, he owned a dance hall called the American Hall in the North End. It was very popular with black and white men and women. He was a musician. He was an entrepreneur as well as a barber. He was also a con man and a scammer. And yet he had a very successful career in Boston. He was patronized by well-to-do people. Whenever he was brought before a jury for some violent act he committed, he was declared not guilty. So yeah, he was really a fixture there in the North End and someone who did make some money.
And that's striking because we follow Clash through a lot of this. And one of the things that's interesting about him is that he knows how to work the system, right? You said a minute ago we had these unusual, or exceptional people who would be successful. But part of what was fascinating to me was I did not read in your telling of what it meant to work and be black in the Boston area in the 1800s that merit was the equaled success. So I'll give an example Octavia Grimes and Reverend Leonard Grimes, who were a married couple who were pastoring 12th Baptist Church. And that really stuck out to me. I mean, Reverend Willie Bodrick II, it comes on the show a lot now. 12th Baptist Church is an active church in Boston now. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., when he preached here, preached at 12th Baptist Church. So we're talking about serious history. They were trying to keep that place alive, and they were doing everything they were supposed to be doing, and yet they were borderline itinerant, and not because they didn't do it well, but because we were structured so that they couldn't succeed.
Well, preachers in Boston had high status. The 12th Baptist Church was known as the Fugitives Church. It had a lot of freedom seekers from the South, and yet it was an impoverished congregation during this period. And that is the key here, that the Grimeses, yes, were aggressive in fundraising, in keeping this church alive, but meanwhile, they had a hard time supporting the family because their congregants were so poor. So there was a disconnect between the status of this couple. They had a very high profile in Boston. They were very well respected by white people.
All the famous abolitionists of the day, like Frederick Douglass, for example, this is where people would come to speak. This was like the place. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
yes.
I want listeners to understand that. Please keep going.
Yes. And yet again, this was the lot of many black preachers in Boston during this period. And I follow one in particular, Peter Randolph, who was born enslaved in Virginia, was a blacksmith, came to Boston, became a tender, a janitor, and then found his calling as a preacher, and yet never really had his own congregation for more than a couple of years. And that was because the people he tended to preach to were unable to support him and his family, so he moved from congregation to congregation.
So this was another piece that was interesting, and we're doing a little bit of popcorn here, but it's to round out listeners' understanding of the past who aren't reading the book, right? So that we can kind of bring it forward. One of the things that struck me is you start early on with a group called the Edlow 66. 66 people who are kept in enslaved in the South until the person, the enslaver, dies.
And Carter Edlow, yes.
And in his will gives them their freedom with money they're supposed to get. Mm-hmm. The family then uses the legal system to deprive them of pretty much everything other than no longer being enslaved. They come north, and you test the thesis that if you're free and come north, we're the promised land, right? By tracking these 66 through a couple of generations, and they really embody the systemic closure to prosperity that our labor force in Boston laid out.
Yes, and I think Carter Selden, who was one of the 66, really illustrates this fact. He was relatively successful in the sense that he was a porter, but he was a porter for the same employer for many years. And that stability made him exceptional. Most black workers were casual laborers. They worked for somebody for a day or two or even a couple of hours, and then they had to move on. We look at Anthony Burns, who was a fugitive from Richmond in 1854, came to Boston. And in the rendition hearing related to his case, he recounts, he and another black man recount all the places they went to look for work in the space of about a month. And it was amazing. It was from one place to another in search of these small jobs that would pay maybe a dollar or two. And that was pretty typical of many black workers during this period.
So, you know, to sort of look at the implications of that, one of the things that you put in the book is between 1895 and 1905, Boston's black residents grew from a little more than 16,000 to 21,000, but less than 2% of the city's overall population. It was growing. Only 4 in 100 black families owned their homes, right? So this idea of today, the state of black Boston and the wealth of black Boston, the report from 2015 that shocked so many people, $8 of generational wealth in black families versus $250,000 roughly in white families, we really can trace this all the way back.
Yes, certainly the social division of labor is key here to understanding the vulnerability of black families over time. The fact that they were committed or relegated to menial labor, could not make much money, and the fact that their children and grandchildren couldn't hope for much better meant that they were renters for most of their lives, and their children and grandchildren were renters. They were not able to accumulate the assets in the form of property that would enable them to own their own home and prosper overall. And this in contrast to many poor whites who in the antebellum period were able to move up the ladder of social mobility.
And gained political prestige and gained access to the halls of power and benefited from the Industrial Revolution because they were able to access it, et cetera. All right, I want to end in a different place. We do have a few minutes left, but I want to spend a few minutes in this place because the other theme that strikes me is the incredible grace and sharing and networks of support that families, pastors, churches, the Black abolitionist community, and I separate them. We've covered on the show the difference between the white abolitionist community in New England and the Black abolitionist community. Not only showed each other, but generation after generation showed to migrants coming from the South, either through escape or through freedom or through the post-Civil War, trying to make a way in the greater Boston area.
Yes, this was certainly a collective effort. Certainly we find couples taking in boarders. These are men and women who have fled from slavery. And the boarding house system really is an institution in Boston that helps migrants get their feet on the ground, helps them to find a job. We see a variety of mutual aid societies, fraternal orders that help their members during this period. I found that many adult children remained in their household of origin so that they could help support their parents in their old age. There are charitable organizations, the churches, missionary groups, and all of these are Black groups, as you say. And these help this impoverished, these all help this impoverished population in really dramatic ways.
So this book, I'm looking at the back of the book right now, and I read it. I'm struck by, you know, Taya Miles writing an endorsement of it, Carrie Greenidge writing an endorsement of it, two Black women historians that we've had on the show quite a bit. This is a laborious piece of research you've done here to really paint every corner of the picture with, you know, as a white woman, a white historian telling the story, strong support from Black historians as well about the sort of the veracity and the completeness of the perspective that you tell. So with all of that in mind, as we go forward now in our conversations here about things like reparations, how much do we need to reset the narrative about who we are in New England? When it comes to the 1800s, the Black population, freedom, ability to self-determine, et cetera, given your research?
Well, I think as you pointed out at the very beginning of this segment, it wasn't the end of slavery that marked a completely new beginning for Boston's Black men and women. We have to look not only at Boston's role in the international slave trade, but also the social division of labor in the city throughout the 19th century in order to understand the bitter legacy of enslavement that lasted well beyond the 1780s and, of course, into the present.
All right. The author is Jackie Jones. The book is No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. It rewrote a story for me. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.